Chapter 1. Newport, Rhode Island, 1890. Ever since the Prince of Wales paid a visit to the United States back in 1860, the female half of New York society had been enamored of the British aristocracy. As American millionaires grumbled about the typical British gentleman's seemingly idle lifestyle and anathema for hard work, their wives devised matchmaking schemes, and their daughters dreamed of being countesses and duchesses. By the time the Earl of Featherstone arrived on their shores in the autumn of 1889, the transatlantic marriage was a commonplace thing, and though the Earl insisted to all of New York society that the purpose of his visit was business, women both inside and outside the Knickerbocker set waved that pesky detail to the side. The Earl was a single man with no money, and business was such a vague term. But though Jack's insistence that he was not looking for a wife didn't stop the ladies from engaging in hopeful speculation, it did reassure the gentlemen of New York that he wasn't there merely to poach one of their daughters. As a result, Jack soon found that not only were the doors of New York's drawing rooms open to him, so were the men's clubs. Within a month of his arrival, he was being invited to every important social event and hearing all the gossip. Within two, he was dining at the Oak Room and playing cards at the House with the Bronze Door. Within three, he and Frederick Van Housen were discussing investment possibilities at Delmonico's over lobster a la Newberg, playing tennis at the New York Tennis Club, and golfing at the newly founded St. Andrew's course. Befriending Van Housen while plotting his destruction could have been every bit as hellish for Jack as Stuart had feared, for the American seemed a charming fellow, witty, intelligent, and easy to like. But the two of them had only been discussing venture capital, stock shares, and African gold mines for a fortnight when Pinkerton agents uncovered a servant girl formerly in the man's employ named Molly Grigg, whose departure from his household was still cause for gossip among his other servants. Curious, Jack had interviewed the girl himself, a conversation that revealed just what sort of animal lurked beneath Van Housen's charming veneer, and made clear the secret Stuart had been keeping. After the discovery of Molly Grigg, Pinkerton's men had found more girls just like her, and with each one he interviewed, Jack found hell a more comfortable place to be. That didn't make his task an easy one, however, for ruining a man, however depraved he might be, wasn't a thing done lightly. It was also a complicated business that required time, patience, and forethought. And to honor Stuart's wishes, the destruction of Van Housen required that he fall into a pit of his own making. Still, by mid-August, Van Housen's pit was well and truly dug, and all that remained was the fall. Knowing what was about to rain down upon the other man after months of work, Jack wished he could feel a sense of satisfaction. But as he studied Van Housen from the other side of an opulent Newport ballroom, he thought of Molly Grigg and Stuart's Duchess and all the others, and he reminded himself it was too early to declare victory. When Van Housen was in prison, then, perhaps, he'd allow himself some degree of satisfaction that justice had been served. But until then, no. Do you think he knows? The question caused Jack to take his eyes off their quarry long enough to glance at Viscount Somerton, who stood beside him. "He knows, Dennis," he said, and returned his attention to the man on the other side of the ballroom. Between the dancers who swirled across the floor, Jack noted the restless way Van Housen paced back and forth and the uneasy glances he gave his surroundings. He thought of their last conversation, of how the other man had come to him only a few hours ago, trying to explain, begging him for help, asking him to intercede with the other investors. He'd taken great pleasure in refusing, but he felt too tense, too on edge to relive that moment of pleasure now.